This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll get an update on where lawmakers stand on the proposed state budget.
First, we'll dig into a new social and demographic shift in the United States, the rise of the single.
Last year, for the first time ever, the number of unmarried Americans was bigger than the number of those who were married. There's also been a big increase in the number of Americans living alone, the number of parents living together but not married, and in the number of Americans who have never been married.
Stephanie Kuntz is with us to break down this huge cultural shift, what one sociologist called the greatest social change of the last 60 years that hadn't already been named and identified. Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to talk to you again.
So big picture, let's start with the numbers. How many unmarried Americans are out there? Single Americans, I should say.
Well, about 30% of American households contain just one person, and more than half of American adults are now unmarried. So it is this huge shift that it doesn't mean, of course, that these people will never marry or never end up in households, but it does mean that marriage no longer organizes the bulk of our lives, and we have to stop assuming that that's the only way people are ever going to organize their social life, their personal obligations, make financial decisions, all of these sorts of things.
And how does this number compare to past data, what we knew before about how many people in the U.S. were married or coupled or anyway, not single?
Well, first of all, it's very important to recognize that the rate of marriage is based upon how many people above a certain age are married. So the rate of marriage is going to seem to fall whenever the age of marriage rises. There have been times in American history when there have been fairly low fairly high rates of singlehood in comparison, for example, to the tremendous universality of marriage in the 1950s and 60s when 95% of the population was married and 80% of households were married couple families. So we do have many more singles, but I think most demographers suggest that about 80 to 85% of Americans will eventually marry. They will just marry at very different times and much later. So we really have to look at singleness as an important part of the life course. You know, back in the 1950s and 60s, the average couple married after knowing each other for only 6 months. Typically, people moved either from directly from their parents' home into their married home, or if they went to college, from their college into their married home, or if they were men who were drafted in the Army. So they never spent any time alone, really, and they didn't have to construct a network of friends and social support systems. That has been a huge, massive change in our culture.
Let's talk a little bit more about who we're talking about when we're saying someone is single. Because you mentioned the people getting married later. So that's one group, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, who maybe still will get married but haven't yet. Could also be people who are divorced, people who are in long-term relations but aren't married. So how do they all fit into this thing that we're calling single?
Well, one of the things that has happened in the last 40 years is that there's many differences within the categories that we used to think of as, oh, the major divisions in society, as there are between those categories. So there's all sorts of marriages today, and as of Friday, that includes same-sex marriages. There's also all sorts of singlehood. There are people who live alone and prefer to live alone. There are people who have been divorced and now live alone. There are people who live with roommates and consider their roommates or friends part of their family. And a good part of the increase in singleness is due to cohabitation, but not all of it. There are more people living alone. Now, and this isn't just an American phenomenon. Interestingly enough, lone living is actually more common in many parts of Europe. So it's something that is associated with a lot of modernization changes. But, of course, we are a little bit behind when we think about it.
Well, we're talking with Stephanie Kuntz right now, professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Talking about the rise of single Americans at historic highs right now. And Stephanie, what do we know about what's driving this rise? What factors from culture are making this happen right now?
Well, one of the biggest factors is the increasing educational attainment of women. That tends to be associated with a rise in marriage. During the 1950s, as more men went to college, women were still getting married quite young. Even if they went to college, they were being told that they should get their MRS degree rather than their bachelor's degree, or they might, in fact, be bachelors for the rest of their life. But once women start to get degrees and really have aspirations for higher education and for careers, you always see a rise in marriage. But there is another contributor too, and it's hard to sort out how much of this is from the positive that people are taking more time to marry, they're taking marriage more seriously, they're wanting to establish themselves emotionally, economically, educationally, and in their career, and all those things bode well for the quality of their marriage and for the length of their marriage. Divorce rates have actually been falling, and every year. For educated couples at any rate, and for every year that a woman postpones marriage right up into her mid-30s, she decreases her chance of divorce. After that, it doesn't rise again, but it levels off. On the other hand, there is another source of delayed marriage in our society that is becoming increasingly important. Back in the 50s and 60s, there was almost no difference in marriage rates and very little difference in age of marriage rates by class, by economic status and educational status. Now there is a huge divide, and we're finding that many low-income people are just delaying marriage because they can't establish the economic security they need, and find that they're just, it looks too risky to them to move into this relationship, and they are postponing it not because of these positive reasons that make them confident that they will eventually be able to marry, but because they just are feeling hopeless about the ability to do that.
That's a marriage gap between classes. How about race? Does that factor in? Are we seeing different patterns of marriage of people of different races?
Well, absolutely. But a large part of that is a class gap. Despite the fact that we now have a strong middle class among African Americans, there is still a huge wealth gap and poverty gap. The unemployment rate is twice as high for blacks. And in addition to the much higher poverty rates and the much higher concentration of African Americans in neighborhoods that lack jobs and support systems, you also have had this massive increase in incarceration. And sociologist Philip Cohen studied several major cities where there were only 67 employed black men for every 100 black women. And so this is a combination of class and race.
So does that mean that a certain percentage of the people in this single category might actually prefer to be married, that it's not really an empowerment choice?
Yes, exactly. There are some people for whom it's a very empowering choice, and other people for whom it is a real loss. Many of these couples cohabit together, and when we do interviews with these couples who are cohabiting, especially the low-income, less educated ones, they will tell you, yes, we do want to marry, we intend to marry, but we have to meet a certain kind of bar before we will risk getting married, because otherwise we're so afraid we'll divorce. Paula England and her colleagues interviewed women women and men who were living together and had a baby, and they all said they wanted to marry, but when asked what it would take to marry, they said, you know, they didn't have like these magical ideas of this big expensive wedding. They said, look, we just don't want to be dependent on anyone, whether it's government or our parents. We want to be out of debt. We want to be able to afford, to have a public wedding that symbolizes our security. And 80% of the couples who met that bar in the next 5 years did get married. A lot of them weren't able to meet that bar.
Now, staying on attitudes toward marriage, whether we think it's important, whether we want to get married, I understand the Pew Research Center tried to collect some data on how many people say marriage is important. So what do those numbers look like? How have they changed over the years?
Well, it's interesting because when the Pew Research marriage asked people if marriage is obsolete, 40% of them said that it was marriage was obsolete in 2010, and only 30% of millennials today say that having a successful marriage is one of the most important things in life. But other polls show that they still say, the majority of them still say they want to get married. And I think there's a big paradox here that I think sometimes we misinterpret on either side of it. Marriage has become less important to people as an institution that organizes their lives, that they feel that they have to join, that they feel they can't be complete without. But in some ways, marriage has become more important as a relationship about which we hold these tremendously high standards. In fact, some people argue the standards are too high, but as someone who studied the low expectation marriages of the past, I'm a little dubious of that with their acceptance of domestic violence and tremendous inequality. But so people actually expect more fidelity, more fairness, more intimacy of marriage as a relationship. And if they don't get it or aren't sure they can keep it, they're more willing to postpone or even forego marriage.
We're talking with sociologist Stephanie Kuntz about the rise of the single American.
And we're taking your calls. Do you see this social change playing out in your life? Is marriage a key part of your plans for the future or just one option among many? Do you think marriage is losing some of its cultural importance in the U.S.? Why do you think there are more single unmarried Americans now than ever before? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion about the rise of single Americans now with Stephanie Kuntz. She's a professor at the Evergreen State College and director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families.
So single Americans, we're hearing, outnumber married people as of last year. We want to hear what you think about that. Why do you think there are more single Americans than ever before, than married Americans now? Do you think marriage is less important now than it was in the past? Why? And how do you think the decline in the number of people who are married will affect American society? And tell us your story. Have you put off marriage? Are you happy about it or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We have Suzelle joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Suzelle.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, you're loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. I am a Unitarian Universalist minister, and what I'm noticing is that more couples, and these are mostly pretty liberal middle-class couples, are waiting longer to marry. And so I'm seeing an increase in the age of the couples who come to me to be married. We do tend to be a little bit of an unconventional religion, so it may not go across all categories. But what I guess I'm seeing that people are taking the decision differently, listening to Stephanie Kuntz talking about people asking more from a relationship in terms of a marriage, greater intimacy, people have higher demands. I think that's part of it. And some of that is, I think, as people know themselves better, they're looking for something beyond security. And again, that's among, a lot of middle class, mostly European American adults who I see. I also see the other side of this that she was talking about in terms of across the class divide, where some of my friends in lower income communities and in the African American community in Milwaukee, marriage just isn't really in the picture. There's a sense of people banding together with family to support each other, but not necessarily making the commitment of marriage. Sometimes it's an economic issue. Sometimes it's just doesn't feel like something feasible to them at the moment.
Thank you so much. It's an interesting perspective there as a clergy person who's been marrying people for a long time, painting some different portraits there of what's going on with marriage. It's a complex thing, isn't it, Stephanie?
Well, yes. And one thing that's really interesting when we think about the greater prevalence of marriage among low-income people and in the 1950s and 60s is that was a period when men's real wages were rising very, very rapidly. They were doubling. And they doubled in a period of 20 years. By 35, you were out-earning what your father had earned at your age. So this was a period when a man had a lot to offer, even if he wasn't always, his behavior wasn't the best. And a woman had a lot of incentive to marry because women's real wages were basically flat, and there were very few job opportunities for them. So now you've got a very different calculus from a woman's perspective, and it's interesting that it's often the woman who is less inclined to get married in some of these low-income couples. Yes, a marriage to a guy who can hold down a job would be fabulous, but what if he can't? And still in marriages, women tend to neglect their own earnings power and make adjustments to the man. If you marry someone and get divorced, it turns out that a low-income woman might be better off having invested in her own earnings power. So it's a whole different set of arrangements than the sort of things that that both pushed women into marriage and gave people an incentive to marriage in the 50s.
Suzelle, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Peggy in Cumberland. Peggy, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Peggy?
Yeah, well, I was wondering if you guys considered that we had more singles in part due to people living longer, and there's a higher percentage of widows and widowers out there who may or may not want to be single.
Oh, that's interesting, Peggy, and I could see it working at the other end. If you know your life expectancy is going to 70 or 80, maybe you don't want to leap into something quite so fast if you know you're going to be with it for another 60 years or so. So on both ends there, Stephanie, is our longer lifespan a factor here?
Well, it's a factor, but not exactly in that way. We've actually, because of lowered death spans, you have people, you have fewer widows and widowers living a long time without remarrying. And there's a much big, because of divorce, there's a much bigger remarket for remarrying. And there's been a huge rise in cohabitation among older people. I think where the longer lifespan comes in is in one of the places where divorce has continued to rise dramatically is in people over 50 and especially over 65. The divorce rate has tripled since 1980, or maybe it's even 1990. And a part of that, I think, is because it was one thing to say, you know, when you were... The extension of our active lifespan has meant that staying together in an empty shell marriage is a lot longer and more laborious than it used to be, and people feel that they have other options outside it. So that's a big challenge to people who are married and want to sustain it, that they have to keep working on it, and, of course, to single people, because aging alone can be difficult, although there's a lot of research that shows that it's more important to just have a social support network of five or six people than it is just to have a partner living with you, and that's the real critical thing, and many older people are living alone successfully.
And Stephanie, sounds like there's also been a big change in statistics related to marriage, particularly happiness studies. What kinds of changes have we seen about that?
Well, There's been relatively stable happiness studies. Some polls show a drop in the happiness of marriage, but as a historian, I'm pretty skeptical of that because people's ideas of what makes them happy change over time. I mean, I have seriously read polls and interviews with women in the 50s and 60s who said, well, we have a pretty happy marriage. He hardly ever hits me. So I'm a little skeptical of the idea that happiness has gone down. The one place, though, that we absolutely know is that there are new tensions over things like dividing the housework, spending time with the kids, spending time with each other. And here's one thing that I personally think is good news. Last year, there was a big lot of attention to a New York Times article that showed supposedly that marriages that were equal had less sex and reported less happiness. And the number of us were skeptical because those were based on studies in the 1990s, which would include a lot of marriages from the olden days. Since that time, Dan Miller and Sharon Sassler and some other people have done studies of marriages formed in the 1990s, and they find that it's the egalitarian marriages that report the most happiness, the most sex, and the most sexual satisfaction, which I think is promising.
Well, Stephanie, we're seeing the numbers. There are more single people than married people. Are social attitudes catching up with that? Are our expectations changing? Are our legal system changing? Are we taking the reality of singles seriously?
Not fast enough. We are not taking this reality enough. I mean, even in the Supreme Court decision on Friday, when in this otherwise very eloquent decision, Justice Kennedy basically said that marriage is the only way that you can stave off loneliness. Well, that's not true. And if we keep assuming it's true and trying to push people into marriage instead of finding other ways to help people reach out and develop social support networks, better housing communities where they can be, even if they're living alone, they can interact better with people, then I think we're headed for trouble. We do have to adjust our and we have to understand, interestingly enough, singles are not selfish. Single individuals actually spend more time and give more help to aging parents and coworkers and friends than married individuals. We should nurture that and value that.
Stephanie, do you think we'll ever get to the point where getting married is sort of anachronistic, that the social fabric shifts enough where that might be more of the unusual thing and the landscape about coupling is just entirely different?
I kind of doubt it. I think that we are moving to marriage being more optional and to accepting that. We now find that couples who cohabit often will have their child before they marry, but they tend to, but couples that stay together and eventually and have children eventually do marry, even in the Nordic countries where marriage and cohabitation are basically regarded as similar. So I don't think marriage is over, but I do think that we are beginning to recognize that there are other arrangements that work and that that we must accept and make allowance for.
Well, Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Stephanie Kuntz, Professor of History and Family Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families. She joined us to talk about the rise of single people in the United States.
And you can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the rise of singles in the U.S.? They outnumber married people now. Is that your story?